You're listening to a very special edition of Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st November 2012 from London and New York on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to a special US election edition of Midori House. From London, I'm Steve Bloomfield.
And from New York, I'm Aisha Spears. There are just 5 days to go until Election Day, and with Hurricane Sandy cleanup well underway, the campaigns are beginning to get back to normal.
Today we'll be taking a look at foreign policy. Xenia Dormandy, a former State Department official and current Chatham House expert, will be analysing the two contenders' views and telling us what a Romney administration could mean for the rest of the world.
We'll be judging the campaign's policies for business. Lauren Feldman, the New York Times small business editor, will be joining us from New Jersey.
We'll be getting on the road again, catching up with our team of correspondents and reporters across the country, including a closer look at some of the House and Senate races.
Our Washington correspondent, Sasha Isenberg, will bring us the second installment in his guide to the swing states. Today, we're in New Hampshire in the Northeast and Iowa in the Midwest.
Economic and domestic concerns will be more of a sort of driver of people's votes, and the thinking is that that makes Romney a stronger candidate there than McCain was.
Then we head south of the Rio Grande. Brazil's relationship with the US has barely been mentioned during the campaign, but the impact of the vote will be felt strongly there.
The American election is important for the Brazilian government, for trade between the United States and Brazil. But it's not important for the Brazilian population.
Finally, we'll welcome back pollster Julia Clark from Ipsos for our daily look at what today's polls are telling us.
That's all coming up right here on our Midori House US election special, live from London and New York on Monocle 24.
So a lot to discuss and get stuck into over the next hour. But first, over to London to get the latest news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
President Barack Obama is back on the campaign trail today, having suspended political rallies because of the devastation caused by Hurricane Sandy, which killed more than 70 people in the United States. In New York, limited services returned on some train and subway lines, but more than half of gas stations remain shut. Commuters like Adam Rushbaum were relieved to have found a way to get back to work.
More convenient for sure. I walked to work yesterday. So I walked about, 70 blocks of Chick-fil-A, it was an hour and a half. So it's definitely nice to be back on the subway. It's nice to see that they've managed to keep everybody in flux. So, it's nice.
New York's LaGuardia Airport has just resumed flights after being closed as a result of Hurricane Sandy's strong winds and torrential rains. United Nations human rights investigators have today said that Turkey is using its counter-terrorism law to prosecute a high number of activists, lawyers and journalists, often held for long pre-trial periods without access to a lawyer. Michael O'Flattery, the committee vice chairman of the UN Human Rights Committee, said some provisions were incompatible with international law.
We're worried about the vagueness of the definition of the terrorist act in the 1991 law, the very far-reaching, unacceptable restrictions on the right of due process for accused people, and the high number of cases in which human rights defenders, lawyers, journalists, and even children are charged under the anti-terrorism law, and not for terrorism, but for the free expression of their opinions and ideas, in particular in the context of non-violent discussion of the Kurdish issue.
Union officials have said today that an indefinite strike by more than half the workers at Mombasa has paralysed work at Kenya's principal port. Simon Sang, Secretary General of the Dock Workers Union, said management were meant to employ casual workers by the end of October, but this had not yet happened, prompting the industrial action.
Management have failed to do what they are supposed to have done by the 31st, because the conciliation which was made in a tripartite meeting, that is between the government and the management and the union, was that they are supposed to have released the 3,200 letters by the 31st of October. The failure to do that is what has caused these guys to come and camp here waiting for their letters.
At the end of her tour of the Balkans, the US Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, has received a warm welcome from the Albanian Prime Minister, Sali Berisha, on a visit to the capital, Tirana, today.
So much has happened over the last 100 years. But one thing has been constant. The United States of America has been your friend and your partner, and we are very proud of that. For Albania's democracy to thrive, Albania's leaders will need to build a culture of cooperation that transcends political differences.
And finally, researchers from the University of Vienna say that an Asian elephant named Koshik, now at Vienna Zoo, can imitate human speech, saying words in Korean that can be understood by speakers of the language. Cognitive biologists explain that the reason why the elephant speaks fluent Korean is because Koshik was the only elephant living at the Everland Zoo in South Korea for about 5 years in his youth, with only people for company during an important phase for bonding and development. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
There we are, talking elephants. We give you all the stories here at Monocle 24, even those that some people would consider aren't really news. Jonathan Wheatley, thank you very much. It's 1806 here in London, 1406 on the East Coast. You're listening to the second of our Midori House US election specials, live from London and New York on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Where are you, London? This is Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando.
London. London,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House live from London and New York with me, Steve Bloomfield, and in New York City, Aisha Spears. Aisha, first of all, how is your city doing today?
I think it's a little bit better for maybe 45-50% of the city. So some subways are up and running. Uptown is kind of feels, this is in Manhattan itself, feels like nothing's really happened. Downtown, we're still without power. But we've been told, we've been promised by Con Edison that the latest we'll get power back is on Saturday. So I think everyone's holding out and there's a little bit of a light at the end of the tunnel. But in the outlying boroughs, it's looking a lot worse.
So it seems. And there's been obviously a lot of coverage today about the cleanup. President Obama's been with Chris Christie, governor of New Jersey, looking at what's happening there. In New York City, has there been, obviously we're seeing a lot of Mayor Bloomberg on TV, has there been much politics about the cleanup in New York, or has it been fairly sort of politics-free?
To be honest, Steve, it's kind of hard for me to say because I don't have power. So my only news source at the moment, apart from when I come into the studio for a few hours each day, is a little wind-up radio, which has fast become my most important possession. So I can catch little bits of news on NPR as often as I can. I think most people have been quite happy with how the city has handled it so far. I'm sure if things don't start to look a little bit more normal next week, people will lose patience with authorities. But both Mayor Bloomberg and Governor Cuomo for New York and New York City and Governor Christie for New Jersey have done outstanding jobs. And Cory Booker has really come out as a leader in New York. He's personally going around to people's houses and helping them and inviting them to his house to charge bits and pieces of equipment they can't charge at home without electricity. So I think the leaders of the cities that have been affected have been doing quite well.
They have indeed. Aisha, thank you very much. There is very little to give Mitt Romney cheer in the first batch of polls that have been released so far today. Obama is up in Wisconsin, New Hampshire and Iowa, swing states, all of them. We'll be crossing to Wisconsin in a moment. But first, let's catch up with our Washington correspondent, who today is in Columbus, Ohio. Sasha Eisenberg, welcome to Midori House.
Thanks, Steve.
So you're in Ohio, a state which is becoming pretty much the only state that anyone really cares about at the moment. Everyone connected to the Republican campaign seems to be there. Is it helping them in any way?
Well, I think we're going to sort of see this big last-minute messaging push out of the Cincinnati suburbs tomorrow night, where Romney and Ryan will be together for the last time, and then sort of all their top surrogates, McCain, Marco Rubio, the spouses, and then people sort of fan out from there around the rest of the country. And there's another weekend of early voting starting tomorrow that they'll go through Monday, so there'll actually be the opportunity for them to mobilize votes here in Ohio, in addition to sort of using surrogates to persuade the very few voters who seem to be still up for grabs. All the indications are from this polling is that the race is more or less where it was before the first debate, which is that Obama has a significant and consistent lead in just about every swing state. And they look like small leads, but it's a lot of little small leads that are being replicated in poll after poll. And Ohio is slightly larger than the others and makes it really difficult for Romney to imagine how he would get to the White House without stopping Obama here.
Sasha, we're going to be speaking to a gentleman from Wisconsin Public Radio later on. And I wonder what you think. Some people are saying that Romney's focusing a lot more on Wisconsin because he's, in a sense, giving up on Ohio. He said that, okay, he's conceded that perhaps Obama has that in the bag. What are your thoughts on that?
No, I don't think they're conceding it. I think that, you know, the fact that Ohio's getting attention from Romney himself tomorrow is a sign that he's not conceding it at all. That said, I think that there's a sense that there's a really hardened anti-Romney electorate here. It's a more working-class white demographic than Wisconsin is, and I think, which is one problem. I think the auto bailout and the success of the Obama campaign in sort of attacking Romney on Bain and sort of rich guy stuff and sort of contrasting it with or juxtaposing it next to his opposition to the auto bailout makes this really tough territory. And I think that Republicans were sort of so encouraged by Scott Walker's win in fighting off the recall in June and the sort of sense that it gave that they knew organizationally how to bring their voters out in Wisconsin, that there's a bit more optimism within the party about Wisconsin. But, you know, Ohio has twice as many electoral votes as Wisconsin does. So it's not an even trade, even if they can ensure winning one at the expense of the other.
Sasha, President Obama's back on the trail today. He's managing to visit three states. How is his campaign likely to change, given that he's just spent the last 4 days either in Washington or in New Jersey dealing with Hurricane Sandy? Do you expect there to be a different tone to the Obama on the stump today as compared to last week?
Maybe a little. I'm not sure whether the storm will end up having preempted it as much as it sort of set a little bit of the mood music for the steady hand on the till, sort of responsible, bipartisan, competent leader. I think the more revealing sign towards that was that they just released a 30-second spot in something like 11 states, and the ad had Colin Powell, who came out, endorsed Obama about a week ago for the second time. He did it in 2008. And it's a testimonial from Colin Powell that basically said we should stay the course with Obama. It was a very status quo message. It was a very establishment, responsible. The guy's been a solid president. He deserves more time. It was very much a conceding the sort of hope and change thing. That I think, was a sign of where they think that the little bit of movement among persuadable voters is. And I think that they want to make this about risk aversity. And they want to make voters, much as Bush did in the last few days of the 04 campaign, these are tough times. You know this guy. Do you really want to take a risk of going with somebody new who you may sort of not be as comfortable with? And so probably they'll want to use Obama's own appearances to reinforce that idea. And I think that the imagery of him and Christie and just sort of being commander-in-chief and leading the emergency response reinforces that.
Sasha Eisenberg in Columbus, Ohio, thank you very much. And we'll be hearing more from Sasha a little later when he returns with a second installment of his Swing State Guide. Now let's cross to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which we were just talking about, where Chuck Quernbach from Wisconsin Public Radio has been at an Obama event hosted by Bill Clinton this morning. Chuck, thank you very much for joining us. So tell us a little bit about this morning's event and if you can paint the picture of what it was like to be there.
Well, hello. Yes, former President Clinton was at the University of Wisconsin Waukesha, a two-year campus that's part of the Wisconsin system, and it's Republican territory out in Waukesha. This is the Milwaukee suburb, about 20 miles west of the city, but there's plenty of Democrats there. It's one of the third largest number of Democrats of counties in the state of Wisconsin, so it's vital that the Democrats, get strong turnout out there as well. So President Clinton talked about the student loans. He talked about Medicare. He talked about the Obama budget, all in very, very favorable ways, obviously.
Chuck, this is a state that, as we were just hearing, the Republicans thought they might have a good chance in because of everything that's happened there with Scott Walker. They also then chose Paul Ryan, who's from Wisconsin, as Romney's running mate. Are you surprised that they haven't had sort of more of a chance here in Wisconsin? Because it does look as if it's sort of leaning Obama's way.
Right, the Marquette University poll yesterday and a poll today out by Wisconsin Public Radio in St. Norbert showing Mr. Obama 8-9 points ahead, perhaps. Well, you know, the Democrats have been saying all along, since Paul Ryan's nomination was announced, that we know Ryan and we're going to tell this story about him. And so they've been very active in telling the not just Wisconsin folks, but across the nation, what they think of what Ryan's performance has been in Wisconsin as a congressman for the last 14 years. But yes, Scott Walker now is back out campaigning with Republicans, not only the Romney folks, but also Senate candidate Tommy Thompson, trying to work his magic that he did in June, see if it'll carry over for November. But so far, it hasn't come across that way in the polls.
Chuck Wernbach from Wisconsin Public Radio, thank you very much. Now, there are, of course, some parts of the country where it's possible the whole election could pretty much pass you by. The sort of places where one candidate is so far ahead, it's not worth anyone buying a single ad, let alone visiting. Hell would have to freeze over before the Republicans had any chance in San Francisco. Our correspondent in the Bay, Alistair G, joins us now. Alistair, do you even know there's an election going on over there?
I mean, you know, in as much as my dentist this morning was, you know, talking about how much he loves Obama, yes, but not really. I mean, on 538, Nate Silver's election blog on the New York Times, California is shown as having a 100% chance of an Obama win. Pretty much the same for Oregon and Washington. The only real sort of issue swing state in my area is Nevada, but even that is likely Democrat and has a very small chance of playing a role. So in the West, I mean, it's almost as if there isn't an election going on. What is interesting in California, as usual, is the propositions that are up for votes. California has this direct democracy system where voters can put things on the ballot as long as they get enough signatures. So one of the major issues this year is the death penalty, which is Proposition 34, and some people have called for the ban of the death penalty. Now, what's interesting is that the person who is calling for this ban is the former warden from San Quentin Prison. He used to be in charge of death row prisoners. And the argument that they're making for banning the death penalty isn't a humanitarian one. They're making an economic argument. They're saying that it's going to save the state $100 million a year, and that money can be invested in efforts to find and prosecute criminals. There's another interesting proposition on the ballot, or rather a worrisome proposition on the ballot, and this one was initiated by the governor, Jerry Brown. And sort of quite sensibly, of course, the tax increases on the wealthy, those earning above $250,000, and they hope to raise around $6 billion annually. The worrying part is that Jerry Brown has already built this tax raise into the budget, meaning that if this proposition doesn't pass, if voters don't approve this this tax increase, they're going to be around $6 billion worth of automatic cuts to education and public services. And right now, I read today that that proposition has sort of less than 50% public support. So waiting to see what happens with those automatic budget cuts. But yes, as you said, California's issue in.
Alistair, it's a similar situation, obviously, in New York City. I think sometimes people think that, you know, that California is the bear republic and New York City could secede from the union and it wouldn't really make much of a difference. But do you feel that because you have this proposition situation, that people are focused a lot more on state electoral situations, voting on all these different specific issues, rather than thinking about the national issue at hand, which happens on Tuesday?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, everywhere in the city, you don't see sort of Obama, Biden versus Romney, Paul sort of banners and posters. What you see is, you know, yes on Prop 34 or no on Prop 32. You know, these are just sort of very local but very resonant issues. So, for example, something across the Bay in Berkeley called the sit line measure, which would prevent homeless from sleeping on the streets. These are the kinds of things that are getting attention in California rather than these bigger national issues, which of course people are concerned about, but we don't really have much of a say in because, you know, they've got our electoral vote, electoral college votes, and that's a shoe in. So that's a given. So yeah, as you say, well, what's of interest here is the propositions.
Alistair, thank you very much for joining us. Now, in the studio, we have Zainia Dormady, Senior Research Fellow in US Foreign Policy at London's Chatham House. Zainia, welcome.
Hello, good to be here.
Very good to have you here. We're going to be talking about foreign policy a little later in the show, but I just wanted to ask you one quick question about when you look at the state of the races, plural, at the moment, there's obviously a huge amount of attention at the top of the ticket with Obama and Romney. What are the interesting races for you in terms of the House and the Senate, and how important do you think those are going to be?
I think they're incredibly, enormously important. I'd actually, you know, one thing I'd say about California and New York and other states that are non-swing is, you know, you're absolutely right. We don't care about the results there because of who's going to win the presidency. But a lot of people are talking about now about the fact that the Electoral College could go one way and the popular vote could go another way. And this, of course, we saw in 2000 between Bush and Kerry. And your vote does matter on the popular vote. So I voted in California. Doesn't matter what I voted except for the popular vote. And then it starts making a difference. But you asked me about the states and whether the states really matter, whether Congress and Senate does matter. The answer is yes, of course. I mean, the president has enormous amounts of power to lead the administration in certain directions. But the reality is there's, that he is constricted by Congress. And you've seen that, particularly over the last 2 years with President Obama. He might want to move certain agendas, but if Congress doesn't agree, and of course the House has been Republican, he's restricted. And so it really does matter how both of them go down. We know that the House is going to continue to stay Republican. The real question is does the Senate stay Democrat or not? At the moment, based on the polls that I've been seeing, the Senate probably stays Democrat. But that's as much to do with, if you'd asked me that question 8 months ago, I would have said it probably would have gone Republican. But there have been a couple of Republican senators or senator wannabes who have managed to put their foot in it quite effectively over the last few months.
Yes, any male Republican candidate talking about abortion and or rape seems to be getting himself in a little bit of trouble.
Indeed.
We'll be talking a little bit more about some of the state races later on, as well as foreign policy. You're listening to a very special edition of Midori House here in London and New York.
As more and more governments demand cuts in public spending, design in healthcare is viewed more often than not as an unaffordable luxury. But design-savvy Denmark, not surprisingly, recognizes the curative potential of good design.
If you should look at the outcome for the patients, you should really think about the design, about the inclusion of nature, about the inclusion of organic materials, because it really lifts the patients.
Monocle Films drops in on a hospice that feels more like a home. Broadcasting now on monocle.com. This is the Midori House election special with Steve Bloomfield and Aisha Spears.
18:22 here in London, 14:22 in New York City. You're listening to the second of our Midori House US election specials. I'm Steve Bloomfield in London.
And I'm Aisha Spears in New York, and it's time to introduce today's guest. We've already heard a little bit from Xenia, and I'm delighted to say we're also joined by Lauren Feldman, the small business editor of the New York Times, who is stranded in New Jersey. Lauren, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you're well. How did the hurricane affect you?
I'm very well. We're hanging in there. Unfortunately, at my home, we have no power, no heat, no internet, no way to cook food. But we're muddling through, and I've managed to find a sanctuary at Princeton University where I have excellent Wi-Fi access. That's so things are good.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for taking time. So let's get straight into it. I mean, Obama has resumed his campaign, and one of the things that Romney attacked him for this morning, somewhat poo-pooed him, is the idea of a cabinet, a minister in the cabinet for business that Obama mentioned recently. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, it's very new. There was a reference to this previously with talk of combining a bunch of departments. That was something that Obama put forward, I think, the beginning of this year or the end of last year. And it always seemed a little sketchy to me. There were a lot of decisions that remained to be made. And, the issue there was that it seemed to be combining big business with little business in a way that inevitably would have to favor big business. So I think there's probably going to be a good bit of skepticism about that until the details are better known.
Lauren, you talk to a lot of small business people and entrepreneurs every day for your work. When you're talking to them about the election and what they expect from government or what they hope for from government, what are the big issues that they talk to you about?
Well, there's no question that small business owners tend to lean Republican. Whatever surveys I've seen tend to put the figure somewhere around 2/3 to 1/3. I think among my readers and thus among the people I talk to, I would guess the odds are, more 50-50. So there's a dramatic split there, and the expectations are dramatically split along those party lines. But if there's one overwhelming concern that everybody shares, I think, it's with getting the economy on track. Everybody would like to have more demand for whatever it is they're selling.
Zania, here in London, I mean, that's the one big issue that's loomed over this whole election has been the economy and how it should be fixed. Romney bashed Obama for a very long time about unemployment being over 8%. Now it's gone down below that very important psychological number to 7.8%. Do you think that will still be, despite everything else, whether it's the hurricane, whether it's what happened in Benghazi, whether it's what you think of healthcare, that when most people come to vote, that will be the big issue? Who is best placed to get America out of this hole?
If you look at any of the polls, they will all tell you that the top two, three issues are economics or economic related. So it's unemployment, it's the debt ceiling, it's social security and social spending, and is there going to be a safety net? It's GDP, GDP growth. I mean, the top issues are without question economic. You know, reverting back to James Carville's, it's the economy, stupid. I mean, that still holds that perception of that reality, I should say. So there's no question that economics is most important. But I think at this point, and I would say actually arguably for the last few months, it's much less, for most voters, it's much less about what's the number of, you know, unemployment. Is it 7.8 or is it 8 or is it 8.2? What's the GDP growth? Is it 1.3% GDP growth or is it 1.5%? They don't care so much about that. What they care about is the direction. So is life getting better? Are the numbers going up? Or if it's unemployment, are the numbers going down? And they care about themselves and their immediate circle. So is my life better? Is my friend's life better? Does so-and-so now have a job? It's much more personal at this point rather than kind of the numbers that you see all over the newspapers every morning. And in that respect, if you look at the numbers over even just this year, the last kind of 8 months or so, they're all trending in a positive direction for Obama. And there's a real sense, I mean, I saw just last week, consumer confidence numbers are improving. That helps. It's whether the consumer says, yeah, life is a little better than it was yesterday, and I think it's going to be a little better tomorrow. And that personal sense rather than the numbers help.
Lauren, Mitt Romney has tried to paint himself as a businessman. I mean, well, he is a businessman, but he's tried to say, look, I'm the guy who can get American working again because I've been there. I know all this. And Obama's been relatively effective about saying, well, look, he may call himself a businessman, but it's all in private equity, and we know what those guys are like, and they've made Bain Capital sort of the scariest thing you could ever possibly think of. Do you think that those attacks from Obama have had an effect, or when you're talking to entrepreneurs, do they look at Romney and think, yes, he's one of us?
I think there definitely is some sense of that. And, you know, if you look at where small business owners traditionally have fallen in political terms, they are obviously big believers in pulling themselves up by their own bootstraps, being independent. You know, there's a reason Mitt Romney did that whole "they didn't build it" thing. And for that reason, I think a lot of small business owners just look at the choice and say, I want to know that whoever's in that seat is going to do whatever can be done to restrain government expenditures as much as possible and keep taxes as low as possible. And there's an awful lot of noise, an awful lot of accusations that go back and forth, but I think they instinctively tend to look at Mitt Romney as the person who's more likely to focus on those issues.
Lauren, thank you very much indeed. Zania, thank you too. We'll be speaking with both of you a little bit later in the show. You're listening to a Midori House US election special here on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour of the program, we'll be asking what the election means in Brazil. We'll get our daily polling update with Julia Clark from Ipsos, and we'll hear part two of our man Sasha Eisenberg's guide to the swing states.
Economic and domestic concerns will be more of a sort of driver of people's votes, and the thinking is that that makes Romney a stronger candidate there than McCain was.
But first, here's Jonathan with the headlines.
Thank you very much. President Barack Obama is back on the campaign trail today, having suspended political rallies because of the devastation caused by Hurricane Sandy, which has now killed more than 80 people in the United States. In New York, limited services returned on some train and subway lines, with the city's LaGuardia Airport just resuming flights just a moment ago after being closed as a result of the storm's strong winds and torrential rains. United Nations human rights investigators have today said that Turkey is using its counter-terrorism law to prosecute a high number of activists, lawyers and journalists, often held for long pre-trial periods without access to a lawyer. Union officials have said today that an indefinite strike by more than half of the workers at Mombasa has paralysed work at Kenya's principal port. Casual workers were meant to be employed by the end of October, but this hasn't yet happened, prompting the industrial action. At the end of her tour of the Balkans, the US Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, has received a warm welcome from the Albanian Prime Minister, Sali Berisha, on a visit to the capital, Tirana, today. More news at the top of the hour.
Thank you, Jonathan. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. It's the second of our US election specials, and we're coming to you live with me, Steve Bloomfield, here in London.
And me, Aisha Spears, here in New York. Well, we heard yesterday how the election is being watched in Korea, and for today's global report, we turn our attention to Brazil. In the third and final presidential debate on foreign policy, Latin America was on the tip of both candidates' tongues. Talks of increasing ties with the region seem evident regardless of the election's outcome.
And this is more important than ever for Latin America's largest country, Brazil. There are just over 25,000 Americans living in Brazil, and many of them will cast their votes from American consulates dotted throughout the country. There are also more than 350,000 Brazilian Americans who are eligible to vote too. Monocle reporter Sheena Rossiter met with some voters in Sao Paulo to get their take on how the race to the White House is shaping up in Brazil.
But I also believe that when he said behind closed doors that 47% of the country considered themselves victims.
The three U.S. presidential debates beam out of Brazilian television sets across the country, an unusual substitute to the usual soap operas and football. Dubbed over in Portuguese, Brazilians have been able to tune into Globo TV to watch President Barack Obama and Governor Mitt Romney battle with their words. But how important is the race to the White House for the average Brazilian? Not much, according to chief editor at Record News, Heródoto Barbeiro.
The American election is important for the Brazilian government and for trade between the United States and Brazil. But it's not important for the Brazilian population. Brazilian population know who is Obama, but I think that they don't know who is Romney. And what are the differences between Obama and Romney? They look at the television or the broadcaster news, and we tell something to the people, but this is not important. That's why we have so little time in our programs to talk about the American election.
Jobs. Number two, open up more trade, particularly in Latin America.
The prevalence of Latin America in both candidates' foreign policy rhetoric has captured the attention of Brazilians watching this election. But it's not an issue which is divided along partisan lines, explains Michelle Chernobylsky. She's a Brazilian-American and the government affairs manager at Sao Paulo's American Chamber of Commerce.
Both have a very similar stance in foreign policy regarding Latin America. Not much is going to change. And we're in a moment right now where the momentum is already there. They have created a momentum that it doesn't matter who wins. This is going to continue no matter what. And we both need each other. We're very dependent on each other commercially, politically, And so it only makes sense for us to grow closer and closer together, no matter who wins the election.
One local issue that does concern Brazilians is the U.S. stance on immigration.
This used to be a bigger issue when Brazil wasn't doing so well and the U.S. was doing better and we had mass immigration to the U.S. It's still important. You have big communities of Brazilian immigrants in the U.S.
A handful of Brazilians have dual citizenship and are voting in the U.S. elections from here in Sao Paulo. Most are liberal and vote Democrat, with polls suggesting that 65% of Brazilians would prefer Obama re-election.
Almost everybody I know is somewhat frustrated with performance by Obama. But on the other hand, Romney is not acceptable by any means. I think the you Brits call him Nit the Twit, right? Nit the Twit.
That's Jim Wattengale. Originally from California, he now votes in the staunchly Democrat state of Massachusetts. He came to Brazil over 30 years ago, but he has still made the point to vote in American elections.
I voted in most elections since I've been here, and in the past, voting is rather difficult bureaucratically. This time around, it's much easier, but it's still, you have to work at it, because as you know, voting is not obligatory in the U.S.
Dare I ask you who you voted for?
It starts with an O.
But for some voters, it can be a toss-up, as Florida voter Carlos Haddad says.
I don't have a party. I voted most on my values, and the guy who is closer to my values, that's the one I vote for. Yeah, I'm going to be voting for Romney, because he is the guy who is closer to the values I have. People have to vote more with their values than what the candidates are saying. You know, you have to go and do your homework. That's important.
And with the race still so close, voters such as Jim Wattengale aren't resting on their laurels just yet.
I think the more astute person does pay attention is worried a little bit about Romney.
That worry is pushing the Democrat community in Brazil to vote from abroad, says former Democrats Abroad chairman Tracy Harrison Pichotto.
I think people are making an effort to vote even from abroad, because even though there's been a lot of concern with Obama and he's not living up to his promises, he's weaker than expected, I think they are really, really concerned that Romney might win.
No matter who comes out victorious on November 6th, many Brazilians don't think that an Obama presidency or a Romney one will make much of a difference here. But American expats like Tracy Harrison Pichotto are still heading to the polls anyway, hoping to make a difference with their votes for friends and family back at home.
In fact, I just dropped off my ballot at the U.S. consulate. I hope Obama wins.
For Monocle, in Sao Paulo, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
I assume you're all standing up for that bit at the end. Thank you very much, Sheena. We'll be hearing more from around the world throughout our election specials. Tomorrow we're off to Kenya, which obviously was not Barack Obama's homeland. I'm joined in the studio here in London again by Xenia Dormandy from Chatham House. Xenia, when we look at foreign policy for Obama and Romney, it's quite easy to look at that foreign policy debate and think, well, they seem to agree with each other quite a lot.
You're absolutely right. I mean, what most people are saying, and I agree with the consensus, which is largely the two sides are actually quite similar. And there's a reason for this. In the end, America's interests don't change. So, you know, the America's interests from Bush Senior to Clinton to Bush Junior to Obama to, if it is, Romney, the interests aren't going to change. And so to some extent, you shouldn't expect to see America's policy changed. You've also got the fact that both candidates are going to be restricted by resources, money, austerity, and by Congress. And so again, you've got a lot of restrictions, you've got a lot of setup that means the two candidates are actually going to have to pursue a very, very similar foreign policy. On the other hand, they will differ both in terms of how they go about pursuing that foreign policy. We know that Romney has talked about increasing defense spending very much, the Republican Party more broadly, very much focused on hard power, whereas Obama has shown himself to be focused on soft power, if you will, development assistance, cultural exchange, et cetera, et cetera. So it's the how and it's the who. That's going to really change. You know, Obama has reached out to non-traditional friends and allies and some non-friends and allies, you know, right back from his inaugural speech, reaching out to Iran. Romney will most likely stick with the traditional allies, with Europe and with those in Asia. So you are going to see not so much differences in the what, but the how and the who. And then finally, I would just say you'll see difference in how they're seen. And, you know, you look at the polls in Europe and something like 70-80% of Europeans would vote for Obama over Romney. Obama is a European leader. And Romney is a much more assertive, aggressive, America. People don't like to see that. And so how the two are received will change. And I think that's probably the most important factor to remember.
Zenia, let's talk about Romney's, you know, obsession with being the kind of business leader of the future for the whole nation of the United States, and how he would perhaps treat Brazil within that. His belief in free trade and his desire to expand free trade to countries like Brazil and Argentina. Do you think that he could achieve that? And what do you think it would take for him to gain their trust?
So I think you raise a really good point. I mean, the reality is if Romney comes in, probably number one, two, and three on his agenda, if he's able to choose his agenda, and that's a big if. But if he's able to choose his agenda, they're all going to be economic. He's talked about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a economic agreement with Asia. He's talked about a free trade agreement with Europe. He talks about free trade with Latin America. His background would support this. He's really going to be focused on how to move the agenda forward on economic terms, both in and of itself, but also because, as we've already mentioned, there's a really big economic problem looming in the United States and elsewhere. In America, we call it the fiscal cliff, you know, that is going to hit in December. And so economics is going to be top of the agenda again, if he has the opportunity to choose. I suspect some other problems like Iran may get in the way.
And just finally on this point, let's talk about who the Secretary of State might be. Because aside from the President, it's going to be the most, or certainly the way Hillary's done it, you are the most visible person to the rest of the world. We heard in the news earlier that Hillary was in Albania, which by my reckoning, I think means it's up to, what, about 120 countries she's visited in 4 years? It's almost that many. Who are the main candidates on both sides?
So I have to say, one of the things I love about my trips to DC, and I'll be in DC next week, is sitting down for dinner with some of the Washington insiders and just, you know, listening to the debate about who's doing what and who's fighting whom, and they can't get away from it. My last trip to DC, which was just about a month or two ago, the names on the Republican side are Zelik, who, of course, was the former head of the World Bank, former Deputy Secretary of State. He is the head of Romney's foreign policy transition team, but he's also a centrist. He's a realist, and that would really irritate the neocons. But I think he's got a pretty good chance. The other name that's out there is Richard Haass, who heads up the Council on Foreign Relations, used to be the head of policy planning in the State Department, so kind of the think tank part of the State Department under Bush. Again, a centrist. You do hear some neocon names, Robert Kagan occasionally mentioned, but...
John Bolton is even occasionally mentioned, although... that often feels like a little bit... So we're just saying that to keep a few people happy.
Yeah, I mean, I think John Bolton is certainly on Romney's team. I don't think he's... I haven't heard him mentioned as a credible Secretary of State. But, you know, National Security Advisor, who knows? And one of the things Romney's going to have to deal with is somehow to bridge what are the two parts of his party, the neocons and the realists.
And then for the Democrats, the two names that have been mentioned the most are Susan Rice, the current UN ambassador to the UN, and John Kerry. Do you think it's between those two, are there other names as well?
Here's the real question on the Democratic side, and I think it's a really interesting one. If the Senate's close, which it will be, then you really don't want to make John Kerry, who's the obvious name, Secretary of State, because then you have to do another election for his
Massachusetts
Senate seat.
Yes.
And if the Senate's close, you don't want to risk that. So if it's close, which it will be, Kerry's not likely to be Secretary of State, which means I think Kerry's not likely to be Secretary of State. Susan Rice is a name that's been mentioned by many, many people. She's done, by most people's reckoning, a superlative job at USUN, heading up the US delegation to the UN. Whether she would go to let's put it this way.
Is she ready for prime time?
Is she ready for prime time? But there's also a question that a lot of people ask. You know, she has some skeletons in her closet from her Africa days and the NSC. And so the question there is, will those skeletons come out? How will they be received? So who knows?
Indeed. We will see what happens after November the 6th. Zainia, thank you very much for now. You're listening to a US election special of Midori House. We're going to be right back after this with our guide to the swing states.
London, Tokyo, Hong Kong, New York and Toronto. On October the 19th, Monocle opened the doors to its newest shop. Chock full of our regular goodies from Porter bags, Ettinger leather goods, 2013 diaries by Marks and Hakisan ceramic wine cups. Check out all of our collaboration products or flip through the latest issues of the magazine. Find the perfect gifts for Christmas or just a treat for yourself. Visit us on College Street in Toronto or at our other shops around the world. And remember, you can sign up to our weekly bulletin at monocle.com to find out about all of the newest products as they hit the shelves.
This is the Midori House election special with Steve Bloomfield and Aisha Spears.
It is indeed. And it's 1845 here in London with me, Steve Bloomfield, where I'm joined by Zainia Dormady, Senior Fellow in US Foreign Policy at London's Chatham House.
And it is nearly 1446 here in New York. I'm Aisha Spears, and with me on the line is Lauren Feldman, Small Business Editor for the New York Times. We'll hear more from our guests in a moment, but first, it's time for the second part of our guide to the swing states. Here's our Washington correspondent, Sasha Eisenberg, to talk us through Iowa and New Hampshire.
I'm Sasha Eisenberg, and here's Monocle's guide to the swing states.
Sasha, let's turn our attention to Iowa. It's a state that gets an awful lot of attention at the start of an election campaign because it's something that during the primaries, everyone wants to do well there. Is it going to be as important, though, in the race for the White House?
Yeah, I think it's coming down as one of the states that we'll see in play at the end. Obviously, it's where Romney got his first sort of surprise victory, one that was eventually taken back by a few votes and given to Rick Santorum. But it's a place like New Hampshire that has an ongoing relationship with Romney and a state that is sort of ideologically ambiguous. I think it's a very anti-war state, and Obama's success there in 2008, many people thought was that he was able to get independents and Republicans who hated the Iraq war to come around and support him over McCain. Obviously, that's less of an issue. And so I think that there's an idea that the sort of prairie isolationism that that drives voters across the spectrum in Iowa will be less of an issue, and that economic and domestic concerns will be more of a sort of driver of people's votes. And the thinking is that makes Romney a stronger candidate there than McCain was.
You mentioned obviously Romney had an important victory in Iowa. Barack Obama had a very important victory there 4 years ago, a victory which really sort of catapulted him to the top of the Democratic race. Does that help him in Iowa? Is there sort of a reservoir of goodwill towards Obama?
Obama talks about it, amazing nostalgia, over and over again. I mean, he sounds a lot like a middle-aged person like recounting their teenage sport exploits, where he always is talking about the wonderful times he had in Iowa and the connection he has with people there. I think that they have the ability to sour just like anybody else, but there's a real organization, a volunteer network that is deeper and more loyal to Obama there than in many other states, and probably to some degree goodwill among voters, although I think we see that goodwill can turn sour pretty quickly in this environment.
Let's look at New Hampshire. I mean, relatively small, 4 electoral votes, but both Romney and Obama are still fighting hard over all 4 of them, aren't they?
They are, and you know, New Hampshire's been a really pivotal state. Everybody talks about Florida being the margin of difference in 2000, but if a few votes had gone differently in New Hampshire for Gore, he wouldn't have had to worry about Florida. And so it's a state that where Romney has, it's been sort of the closest thing to Romney's home for the last few years. He literally has bought a house on Lake Winnipesaukee. He really used it as the bulwark of his primary campaign. And it's a state that's relatively upscale, very sort of economically libertarian, fiscally conservative. And so if the kind of Paul Ryan message that Romney's only tentatively embraced about entitlement reforms and austerity will have an audience anywhere in the United States, it's probably in New Hampshire. And so that's one big bet that the Romney campaign is making in their messaging, that type of fiscal conservatism will have an audience there.
Again, looking at Iowa and New Hampshire, I mean, they're both states that you know, if you want to be a candidate, let alone be president, you have to do extremely well there. You have to spend a lot of time there. Does that then make these particularly difficult states to run in as the candidates if you've been in a primary and you've, let's say you're Mitt Romney and you've gone quite a way to the right during the primary, and now as the presidential candidate, you're being a little bit more centrist? Are there a lot of people in New Hampshire who look at that and go, oh, hang on, you were here only a year ago and you were saying some very different things?
That's a great question. I mean, I think it's, you know, one thing that I think we tend to overstate in primaries how what look like really big differences among the candidates will play in the general election. And it turns out that, you know, what Republicans who supported Newt Gingrich or Rick Perry or Rick Santorum, in this case, they hate Obama so much that often they're willing to put aside their pre-existing primary differences. But the voters in those states know Mitt Romney well, and they knew Obama well in 2008. And in New Hampshire in particular, they know Romney well because most of New Hampshire is covered by the Boston media market. And so definitely the fastest growing parts of the state are people that were seeing news about Mitt Romney for the 4 years he was governor as well. And so it's a place where he probably has less freedom to sort of cavalierly reinvent himself the way he's done over the years, because there is a real sense of familiarity and institutional knowledge about the positions and sort of style he's had before.
That was Sasha Eisenberg talking to Steve in part two of our Guide to the Swing States. Tomorrow, we'll be talking you through Colorado and Nevada. We're still joined by Lauren Feldman from the New York Times. Lauren, I wanted to ask you a question about a recent number that's come out about private sector jobs. Obviously, across all of these swing states, it's a huge issue. And 158,000 private sector jobs were created in October, and which looks like the last jobs poll number we'll see before the election on Tuesday. How do you think that leaves Obama? Do you think that it'll make him look like he's doing a lot more? He talks about how he's improved the unemployment numbers over his presidency. Or do you think people who are caring about job creation are really going to look to businessman Mitt Romney?
You're asking me from the perspective of a small business owner how they will feel?
Indeed, for people and those who are trying to create jobs in the private sector, yes.
I think those minds have been made up for some time, and I don't think this number will make any difference at all.
And why do you think that people will harp on these numbers in any way then? Is it the same as often now? We're a bit too late. We've got a lot of numbers on polls, and we don't really care so much about them. It's the same with jobs. It's too late, too little, too late.
Yes, I think it's all campaign rhetoric at this point. I think everybody is grasping for whatever straws they can find to make whatever argument they feel they need to make. But if you're asking me what small business owners think, they've known what they think for a long time. Those decisions have been made, and I don't think these recent numbers are going to make a difference.
Zane, we were looking there at New Hampshire and Iowa, and as Sasha said, you know, New Hampshire is quite interesting for Mitt Romney because it's right next door to Massachusetts. You know, they have a very similar media market. Lots of people in New Hampshire will have known Mitt Romney for many, many years, and all the various different Mitts they will have known over the years. Are there? I mean, obviously there are some disadvantages because he's changed his position on some things, but are there actually some advantages for him there in that they've got to know him over the last 10 years or so?
Yeah, they've got to know him, and you know, the reality is for those Democrats who would criticize him, most people would agree he did a pretty good job when he was in Massachusetts, and that clearly, you know, one of the things he's running on is the ability to manage, the ability to get things done, the ability to reach across the lines, the political lines. He talks about that quite a lot, and that's something he was able to do in Massachusetts, and so that will resonate in New Hampshire. And I mean, you have to remember, you know, Massachusetts is a largely Democratic state. New Hampshire is itself quite democratic. And yet he's very, very well respected. For all of his flip-flopping, there are a lot of people who say this is a guy who gets it done, who works across the aisle, who's pretty moderate. It's an important one for him, even though, as Sasha mentioned, I think it's only got four electoral votes.
Four. But you know, never know when it comes down to it. Four might be crucial.
It's you know what, this election is going to be close enough that we say, oh, it's four electoral votes. We say, oh, it's in the margins. The margins really matter. It could make all the difference.
Zainia, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to day two of our US election specials here on Monocle 24. We'll be taking a closer look at some of the Senate polls right after this.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
This is Monocle 24.
It's 14:54 here in New York.
And 18:54 in London. Before we say goodbye for today, time for our daily polling update. And Julia Clark, Vice President of Ipsos, is joining us on the line once more from Washington. Hello again, Julia. I hear you have some Senate races for us today.
Yes, we absolutely do. We're doing state-level polling daily now up until the election, and that, of course, includes the Senate races. The balance of the Senate after this election is going to be very critical to, regardless of the winner of the presidential, if Obama's reelected and he ends up with Republican House and Senate, he'll be effectively a lame duck president and pretty much unable to legislate. So obviously really critical to look at the Senate races as well. In Virginia, we have it the closest, actually, of our state polls. The Democrat, Kane, has a 2-point lead over George Allen, his Republican opponent. So I think that's probably the closest of them. We've got Ohio and Florida, too, although the Democratic candidate in both those states looks a little bit more comfortably ahead.
Julia, stay on the line. Zainia, I just want to bring you in here. Tim Kaine is he was the chair of the Democratic Party. He's up against George Allen, who used to be the senator and was at one stage talked about as a potential presidential candidate in 2008. Then he had a slightly unfortunate incident where he used the word macaca at an Indian American student who was filming him. Are you surprised that he's managed to make this sort of comeback? Julia, I'm just asking that of Zainia here in the studio.
So the answers are, and for the Brits who are listening, you know all about political comebacks. Leaders across the world are able to reform themselves, regenerate themselves, and do it all again. And particularly if they have a reputation of getting stuff done, time goes by and you forget some of the worst of it. And then you say, wait a sec, the guy we've got at the moment isn't doing so good of a job. I have to say, I've been getting emails. I live in London. And notwithstanding the accent, I'm American. I've been getting emails from Kane for over a year now. So I'm...
It's going to be his work.
He's doing his work. It's going to be really, really interesting. It's going to be really, really close. As Julia said. I think politicians make comebacks all the time.
Julia, let's go back to some polls. It looks like, with all the numbers you've given us today, the presidential race, state by state, Obama is looking good. But we've mentioned earlier, when we were talking about the case of California, and the popular vote in the national polls, it's a lot closer than perhaps it should be. Does that mean that Obama is underperforming in his uncontested states?
There's not a great deal of evidence for that. You're going to see polls that show closer and more and less narrow, I suppose, races. There's a lot of state polling that goes on, but I think I would caveat that by the fact that the polling at a state level can be a little bit more mixed. There's more of a dearth of information. There's less polling that goes on, and oftentimes the polling done at a state level is done by slightly less experienced or local pollsters. And so you're always going to be able to find a poll that looks a little bit different. But I haven't seen any evidence so far that some of what we consider to be the safe states for either Romney or Obama are looking to be really in contention. No, our data certainly doesn't suggest that.
Julia Clark from Ipsos, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave that there. We'll hopefully speak to you again tomorrow. That's all we have time for today. Special thanks to our guests, Zainia Dormandy from Chatham House.
And to Lauren Feldman, small business editor of the New York Times in New Jersey. Our engineer on this side of the Atlantic was the lovely Paul Ruest here at Argo Studios. My producer was Barrett Austin, and our researcher was Pauline Eiferman.
Here in London, thanks to producer Case Bilboa and Ben Jay. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time, 1400 hours on the East Coast, bring you the third of election specials here on Monocle 24. For now, it's goodbye from me, Steve Bloomfield in London.
And me, Aisha Spears in New York.
Thanks for listening. Goodbye.